Fugitive. A QM production. Starring David Janssen as Dr. Richard Kimball, an innocent victim of blind justice, falsely convicted for the murder of his wife.
I'm only willing to hear you cry because I am an innocent man. I am an innocent man. Oh, yes, I am.
Ah, that's what they all say, an innocent man. Hi, everybody, talking fugitive with Kitty and Bobby and Ken on the air one more time. And, you know, we're starting to get, kind of into the death throes of the program. That sounds kind of grim. Maybe we should just say, you know, coming near the end of the program. Anyway, it's not over until it's over. And tonight, we're going to be talking about the judgment. It will be Acts 2 and 3 of Part 2 of the Judgment. Now that I have exhausted all of my knowledge on the subject, let me turn it over here to the lead moderator, Bobby Neer.
Thanks, Dave. I am an innocent man. Yes, indeed. That is what Richard Kimball has been protesting long before Billy Joel had a hit record with it. And now, as we prepare to enter the final two acts of the series, it's time to prove it once and for all. Luckily for Richard Kimball, he has plenty of time to do it, because his main nemesis, Gerard, seems to have lost interest and is simply standing around and looking at his watch, reminding people that as of noon tomorrow, that's it, no more time. Now, nobody believes that, certainly I don't, and so there's virtually no suspense at this critical moment. Had Kimball gotten away one last time and been hiding in Donna's house with Gerard about to pounce upon him, just as the truth was about to be told, we would have a completely different story on our hands. It doesn't really matter, since the series is now relentlessly marching to its inevitable conclusion, part of which will be a first-time-ever look for viewers of the actual crime that started it all via a flashback sequence. We will deal with that at length in the second half of today's program, but first we have a few loose odds and ends to tie up in the second act of Part 2, which turns out to be pretty boring, actually. On our last program, we touched briefly on that insane scene at the end of Part 1, where we find out that there is a living witness to the crime, when Lloyd Chandler meets Fred Johnson at the stables, and they make screen and fiction history when a killer actually blackmails the witness. This is the height of insanity, and no matter what I do, I cannot get around it. I've thought about every movie I've ever seen, of every TV show I've ever seen, and every book I've ever read, and I can't point to anything in which this has been done. Nothing. Ken, you've had two more weeks to think about this, think it over. We all know that Chandler, had he any brains, would simply have told Johnson to F off, since he has nothing to sell. Instead, he goes home, comes apart of the seams as he tries to work his way out of it, selling his house, getting his life insurance money, moving away, whatever. So, tell me, tell the world, just what would you have done if you were in the same circumstances where you knew who the killer was and he was attempting to blackmail you?
I have no idea why Part 2 veered into such a ridiculous storyline with Acts 1 and 2. You've got millions of people across the country tuning in to find out the plight of Richard Kimball. He's captured by Gerard. They go back to Indiana. And why Fred Johnson, the one-armed man, goes back to Indiana? And how is he going to find Lloyd Chandler? By calling Donna on the phone? This is ridiculous. I call it a buffoon moment. And there are about 5 or 10 of them in Acts 1 and 2 of the Judgment. And I consider the scene between Johnson and Chandler at the stable the buffoon number one moment of the entire episode. I mean, as the audience, we're tuning in for Richard Kimball and Gerard, and maybe Donna, and obviously the one-armed man. And we've got Lloyd Chandler, and the writer of this episode is just leading us down, like I said last time, the Ivy Maze. We are all in a maze.
Why would Chandler go and meet the one-armed man at all? Doesn't he figure he's being lured there just so the one-armed man can kill him, which is what he should have done back at the scene of the crime? So I don't understand exactly what anybody hopes to gain by any of this. I tell you that if it were me, the only thing I can think of is if you go back to meet him, you simply laugh in his face when he tells you he wants $50,000. You haven't got that kind of money, and there's not a reason in the world to do it. And you invite him to go ahead. Tell the world that you were the witness and you didn't do anything about it, and you kept your mouth shut and let Kimball run across the country for 4 years, and see what he says to that. Or, better yet, simply make a deal. Tell him he's got about 5 minutes to get out of Stafford, and if he ever comes back there again, if he ever even gets close to Stafford and threatens him again or tries to blackmail him, he'll go to the authorities no matter what it means to him personally and get rid of him. But the idea that you're going to listen to this nonsense and then go back home, as Chandler does, and simply go completely crazy, call up all your friends, try to beg for money, tell your wife you want to sell the house, take out your insurance policy, I guess he was threatening to kill himself, I don't know.
Well, can I interject?
Yeah, be my guest. Tell me what's going on here. I don't understand any of it.
Well, you know, the one thing to keep in mind, though, is that the writers really were creating a red herring here, because like I think I brought this up when we were talking about part one, was that Johnson gets bailed out of jail from somebody claiming to be Len Taft. Now, to me, it seemed like, you know, logically, you might think that, well, maybe what if Johnson didn't actually kill Helen Kimball? It would make perfect sense, because the real killer is getting him out of jail because he doesn't want Johnson to cut some kind of a special deal and blab about who the actual killer is. I mean, because you're going with the idea that maybe he's got something to sell. And to the writer's credit, when we saw the confrontation between Johnson and Chandler at the stable, Chandler never says, "I saw you kill Helen Kimball." Both of them are kind of just saying to each other, "I know what happened in the house that night. Well, I know what happened in the house, too." You know, it seems to me like they were trying to create this idea that maybe the one-armed man was actually the witness to the crime.
Well, let me interject here. In that scene at the stables, though, I just watched it again today. The one-armed man looks at Chandler and he says, "Yeah, you're the guy. You're the one who was there that night." So where's the red herring? You give it up right away.
Well, not necessarily. He's saying you're the one who was there, but he's not. He doesn't specify what he was there doing. You know, I mean, to me, it was kind of like a little red herring, saying that maybe this guy, Lloyd Chandler, actually killed Helen Kimball. Because why else would a guy? I mean, it seems to me that if you're going to blackmail somebody, you're blackmailing somebody because you got something to really hang over their head. In this case, Johnson, as we later find out when we see the flashback, it turns out Johnson really doesn't have anything to hang over this guy's head. I mean, Chandler, for all intents and purposes, is a total idiot for doing anything, for bailing him out. I mean, why did he bail the guy out of jail? Because he was afraid that Johnson was going to admit that he killed Helen Kimball and Lloyd Chandler was in the house
problem.
And saw him
yeah.
do it? It makes no sense.
See, I like your idea. The problem is I don't think the writers were smart enough to create a red herring. What you're coming up with is better than I think anything they had in their minds. I think they just wanted to get it over with. And they were, and that's what bothers me about it. If they were really trying to create something unusual, then they would have gone through with it. But, you know, the idea that they had something else in mind and then let it lay there causes somebody like me to come along and say, come on, the whole thing is just too ridiculous. I mean, so what are you suggesting? That what is, Johnson was there, what, that he might have been there with somebody else and was the other person who killed her and he just happened to be there?
No, my theory on it was that they were trying to maybe paint the idea that, okay, Johnson went into the house to rob it, which is what we saw him doing. He walked in there and he was thumbing
yeah.
through things and
yeah.
and he goes in there to rob it, and he ends up walking in on you know, a murder taking place. Of
some, boy, that
or
is
at the very least a manslaughter taking place.
Yeah. The main question I have for both of you is, why is Fred Johnson going back to Stafford, Indiana, where over 4 years, I'm sure the paper has discussed the issue of the one-armed man and Kimball. And, I mean, if he gets spotted in Indiana, I know it's nighttime, but what is he doing in Indiana trying to get $50,000? Kind of far-fetched.
And why did he wait so long to do it anyway? Why wait 4 years? He should have done it a long time ago.
Well, remember he said he didn't know the name of the guy, you know, because remember he called Donna's house demanding that Lynn Taft go meet him because that guy Chandler put up the bail in Lynn Taft's name.
See, it seems really far-fetched because if he's in Los Angeles, he gets bailed out, and then to go all the way back to Indiana, I mean, what's going on? He got on a train or something? Is that
Yeah, they're all on train.
That's a 3-day train ride again.
All right, while we have a few minutes left in the first part of the show, let me get away from this now and get to something else, because in the second half we have to deal with the flashback scene. Nevertheless, while Chandler comes apart like a cheap watch, Kimball and Gerard have set up shop back in Donna's house. And as if Kimball doesn't have enough problems, guess who shows up at the door? None other than that steamy sex bot, Gene Carlisle, who meets with Donna in the living room. And Donna seems absolutely thrilled to learn that Gene seems to have fallen hard for her brother. Then we have another one of those reunion scenes between the two. Donna goes back to the kitchen where everyone is sitting and tells Kimball someone is there to see him. Kimball walks out alone, and Gerard sits calmly at the table and lets him do it. I've watched it many times, including today. I counted the seconds, 10 of them. That's right. And these 10 seconds where Kimball could just have walked right out the front door. But instead, he stops and has another one of those creepy embraces with Gene. Once again, putting his arms around her and then grabbing her arm as if they were pro wrestlers. My goodness, what has happened to this man? Over 4 years, he's had dalliances with the likes of Susan Oliver and Suzanne Plachette and Angie Dickinson. But when he's around Gene, he just doesn't seem up to it anymore. This is absolutely ridiculous. She's in this story. They never needed her. And now that she's in the house, they really don't need her. There's nothing left for her to do. She's just standing around, and it is absolutely sickening. Kitty?
Oh, I agree. I mean, particularly when you consider the fact that, it could have been very interesting if she had whispered to Gene, do you have your car here? And if she had said yes, she's like, good, go out and keep it running.
Yeah, how about that?
Since Gerard is so willing to let Kimball walk out into the living room alone, you know, you'd think that, considering the fact that Gerard called no other cops to come guard the house or anything, you'd think that between Donna and Lynn and Kimball, they could all restrain Gerard and tie him up or something while they went out and investigated all of this.
Well, I think I know the answer.
Everybody's just content to have a party at Donna's.
I think I know the answer to the Gene Carlisle. You remember, if you want to be happy for the rest of your life, never make a fancy woman your wife. That's why no Angie Dickinson's, no Plachette's. He's going, obviously Gene Carlisle could cook. Okay, we'll take a timeout and come back for what? I guess act three of part two of
Judgment.
Yeah, we
got the big flashback coming up. Yeah.
Okay, all right. I like flashing. Okay. We'll be back in just a moment, folks, here on Retro Radio.
If you've enjoyed Talkin' Fugitive over the last few years, then be sure to stick around when KSAV will bring you a new program based on the television classic Twilight Zone. Same episode-by-episode analysis, same in-depth discussion, same interesting and provocative hosts. And it takes place at the same time and channel, so no adjustment of either your computer or your schedule is required. Just keep listening every other Tuesday to KSAV, the reason your computer came with speakers.
I'm only willing to hear you cry because
because I am an innocent man.
Okay, and we are back talking Fugitive, and we've got a caller on the line that wants to talk a little Fugitive herself. So, Helen from the United Kingdom, welcome to Talking Fugitive.
Oh, my gosh.
Hello.
Hi, Helen.
Hi, everyone. Nice to speak to you all at last.
This is the first time you've ever called us, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Oh, my gosh, what is it, about 2 o'clock in the morning there?
Actually, it's only 1 o'clock because you've put your clock forward and we haven't done so yet.
All right, go ahead. What would you like to say?
I was calling about that scene with Chandler and the one-armed man at the stables. No. And the one-armed man takes Chandler's gun and he removes the bullets and he says, I want 50 grand tomorrow and no more of this. And he shoves the gun back to him as though he couldn't possibly have any more bullets that he could take along the next day.
Right.
I thought that was quite mad. And it's kind of out of character for the one-armed man to give somebody their gun back. He's acting more like Kimball would do.
Well, everybody's out of character.
That's
the
thought of that before.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we know how Gerard is acting differently in this episode, and also the one-armed man in this scene.
Do you find this business with the killer blackmailing the witness as ridiculous as we do?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
It makes not a bit of sense, and I like Kitty's idea that it was going to be a red herring and they were setting us up for something else, but it really never happens. That's one of the problems.
Yeah, quite. One other point I was going to make was when Kimball and Gerard start wondering if there maybe could have been somebody else with Helen that night in the house when she was murdered, and they hit upon the bright idea of checking out the phone records. They say it was 5 years since the murder took place, and they've only just thought of that. Gerard took the trouble to interview 83 one-armed men, but they didn't even think of checking the phone records back then to see if there had been someone with Helen on that night.
Right, and we're about to discuss, in the time we have left, the flashback scene in which we finally get to see the crime, and the one-armed man, as I'm sure you remember, leaves his fingerprints all over everything. So, you know, these things go by, and the writers do nothing with them. And the assumption that, I suppose, that viewers are too caught up in the story or too stupid to notice them. So you're right, phone records, fingerprints, all of that, makes you really wonder why Kimball would get in any trouble in the first place.
Okay, Helen, listen, Helen, you didn't call KSAV Collect, I hope, did you? What, you did? Oh, okay, well, listen, we'll have to cut the call short then. No, Helen, listen, we've got to get on with the show, but thanks very much for listening, and thanks a lot for taking the time to call.
Thanks, Helen.
Okay, you're welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Okay, Bob, you go ahead.
All right. I can't believe this is happening. Okay, so we get to Act 3, and this is the time when the viewers of the series finally get to see what happened the night of the crime. Remember, up until now, we have seen absolutely nothing. The only part we've ever seen is when Kimball comes back to the house and finds Helen dead in the living room. So Chandler finally gives in to his wife, and he starts whining in her ear that he's been hiding something for years and years and years. And he finally tells her about it. I don't know why it took him so long, but it did. And now we have this famous flashback scene, and it begins with Chandler in the Kimball house. He tells his wife that they had gone out with Richard and Helen that night we saw when they were had the argument back in the flashback scene back in Little Egypt. And then 2 nights later, apparently he says he was back in the house with her. As we know, Richard had run out of the house. Helen was absolutely hysterical. So the scene begins in the bedroom. Helen's sitting on the bed, and Chandler's standing right there in front of her. I've said all along that the producers have treated actress Diane Brewster like garbage throughout this series, never using her to full effect. And now they give her absolutely nothing. She's hysterical, and she doesn't have a single tear in her eye. Now, this woman is a decent actress, so even if not every actress can produce tears on cue, but even if she couldn't, they couldn't use some false tears. She looks ridiculous. She's hysterical. She's screaming and hollering. She's wringing her hands, but she's not crying. It just simply doesn't make any sense. So to fit in with what we know from previously, she's talking about how she's sorry that they had the argument, that Kimball ran out, maybe he'll never come back. And she hears a noise downstairs. And she goes, oh, it's Richard, and she runs out of the room, and she runs downstairs. And what does she find down there? A one-armed man rifling through everything in the living room and all around the first floor. And as I just said a few minutes ago, Johnson is leaving his fingerprints everywhere. He's not making any attempt to cover up any fingerprints. Helen runs about halfway down the stairway, and anybody with a half a brain would have run back up to the bedroom. Hopefully there's a phone up there to call the police. But no, Helen runs right down into the living room. She's going to fight with him. It's beyond me what she expects to do. So she goes down there and still screaming hysterically until the one-armed man finally picks up that infamous lamp and hits her over the head. Who can blame him? I would have hit her over the head, too. It's unbearable. In the meantime, we see Chandler, who has come halfway down the stairs, and he's simply paralyzed on the stairway. He's cringing, he's crying, he's looking, he's closing his eyes. He can't look. He turns out to be a considerable coward. Now, I don't expect him to run downstairs into the fight, because he would have been killed, too. He also could have run back upstairs and called the police, but he just stands there. Helen's dead now, and the one-armed man takes a look, comes over near the stairway. I expect that Chandler is a dead man. I mean, really, how many times can you fry in the electric chair for a murder? The one-armed man has no reason not to take him out right now. Instead, he simply stands there and gives him a dirty look, as if to say, don't you dare tell anybody what you've seen here. And it's absurd. We already know that apparently Chandler is some sort of a war hero. What war it was, I don't know. He got the Silver Star, but he really didn't deserve it. Everybody in the neighborhood thinks he's some sort of hero. And when they find out that he's really a coward, well, his life will be ruined. But Johnson doesn't know that. Johnson doesn't know who he's looking at. He thinks he's talking to Leonard Dance. He has the slightest idea what's going on. He has no idea anything about it, so he has no reason to stand there and kind of give him this visual warning not to say anything. And he leaves him cringing on the stairs while Johnson runs out of the house. Ken, give me a break here. Why did Johnson not take Al Chandler right then and there?
I guess he was a little paralyzed and shooken up because Helen was clawing his eyes out.
Yeah, I know.
As he says on the tower later.
Yeah, right.
But Bob, this scene was crucial to the entire two-part episode.
Sure.
And the writer and the director completely hacked it and blew it. Number one, the scene should have been in black and white. That would have been more eerie. Diane Brewster,
yes,
she
yes,
should have been similar. I know it's hard to do after 4 years, but she should have looked the same way as she did
right
in the hospital room in The Girl from Little Egypt. Remember how she looked there.
Sure.
Because that's how we remember Helen Kimball.
Right.
Right now, she looks different to me. I didn't like the color aspect to it. The bedroom scene with her and Chandler, and she's crying, and then she goes down, walks. The music was a little creepy, and then you're right. The first reaction for her is to lunge at Johnson, and what does he do? It's almost like self-defense.
Yeah.
You know, grabs the lamp, hits her, the music sets the tone, and then Chandler and Johnson look at each other in the eyes. The camera's kind of going sideways and all that. But Bob, the scene should have been extended. They should have shown Johnson leaving the house. They should have shown Chandler leaving. And then they should have showed Richard Kimball coming up to the door with that famous look.
Sure.
And then maybe Helen's still alive. Why not? You know, add some drama, please.
We waited 4 years for this scene, and this is how it turns out. Go ahead, Kitty.
Well, I would just like to give my take on it. I mean, when I first saw the scene, the where it unfolded in the bedroom, I mean, which is a little bizarre. I mean, why would you have your neighbor come up and talk to you in the bedroom? Yeah, that's a little bizarre. But yeah, the first thing that struck me about the scene, and this is also something that they did, you know, once they switched to color, and you know how they colorized all those photos?
Right.
They always showed Helen in that still photo on the floor in a blue dress.
Oh, I didn't notice that, right?
Yes, and even back, and you know, and I brought it up that in that episode when May God Have Mercy, Victor Leonetti insists to Gerard that he saw Helen in a blue cocktail dress, which implies she was wearing blue. Well, now we find out she's wearing this pink cocktail dress, and quite frankly, she's making the Helen of Girl from Little Egypt look very sane and rational by comparison, because this woman's out of control, except it does appear that she had time to go to the beauty parlor to get her hair cut from the time Richard left and from the time Chandler arrived, because her hair was long and pinned on the top of her head in that Girl from Little Egypt episode, and now all of a sudden it's a nice short bob. But I agree with you. I mean, the acting's terrible. I mean, they can, you know, they do have the ability to put eye drops in an actress's eyes to make her eyes water so she can cry.
Right.
And, I mean, really, her crying is just over the top. It's too much. She sounds like a little kid who's fake crying because they can't get their way about something.
Right.
And when she goes downstairs and sees the one-armed man, she's just going to take him on like she's Wonder Woman. And I never really understood why she would do that, particularly if you recall in the scene, too, that when Johnson saw her and Chandler appear at the top of the stairs, he actually started to make a break for the door because he was like, oh, my gosh, there's people here. I didn't realize there was people here. I got to get out of here.
He thought nobody was home.
Yeah, and she basically blocks his way. I mean, it's like, why are you blocking his way? I mean, he hadn't even stolen anything yet. It was like, you know, okay, leave. If you're going to leave, leave.
They've been trashing Helen ever since the series began. And it's really a shame because, you know, Diane Brewster could do an acting job. They never let her do it. The only time we ever see her as being reasonable was in The Survivors, and she's on the phone.
No,
talking to her
recording.
Mother, we don't even get to see her.
Yeah, it was it was one of those record recordings.
Right, and we never get to see her really act like a human being. So that's a terrible thing. And I guess Diane Brewster needed the work, because you would think she would have said to her agent.
1 minute.
You think she would have said to her agent, look, you know what? If I'm that critical to this series, then give me something to do. Don't just put me in there when you need somebody screaming and acting like a maniac. Because that's the lasting impression that's going to go out. So this is the big flashback scene, and again, it's the same old story. What might have been doesn't really happen. It just doesn't come together. It doesn't make any sense. And I'm forever wonder why it is the one-armed man would simply allow Chandler to stand on the stairway. I don't believe that anybody having committed a murder would do that. Maybe he didn't go, I mean, he didn't go in there intending to commit a murder, but he has done it. And so you've got a witness there. And
although, could it be that he didn't really, you can always go with the idea, too, though, that maybe he didn't realize she was dead. I mean, she could have just been knocked out.
All right, we'll never know, that's for sure.
We are knocked out of time here. So thanks to the three of you.
And thanks to Helen for calling in. I'm going to send her an email after the show.
All right, yes. She was the most intelligent commentator here on the whole thing. Sorry about that.
Sorry, Phil.
We'll be back in 2 weeks for more Talkin' Fugitive. You be with us at that time. Same time, same channel. KSAV Retro Radio. Miracle cure. Some people just accept the world as it is. I'm not willing to lay down and die because I am an enemy.